The following podcast is from the weekly message at Summit Church in Upstate South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Good morning. My name is Nathan Forrest. I'm the family discipleship pastor here at Summit Church, and it is my joy to be with you this morning. Unlike Jason and almost all the guys on the team, I'm not a sports guy. But they do the bracketing, and all the staff guys, they take home a bracket. And I've learned over the years that there's two rules when filling out a March Madness bracket. The first one is you're supposed to pick your team, whoever your team is. Mine's the Tar Heels. And you take your team all the way. If you're a true fan, apparently that's what you're supposed to do. So I did that with this year's bracket. And then the second thing, I was like, listen, I'm tired of always losing. And so I'm going to go to the experts. I'm going to do my research. And so I went on ESPN. I went to the ESPN. And I said, I just looked online. And it said, how to fill out your bracket if you don't know sports. And I was like, that's my article. And I clicked it. And it gave me, like, these are going to be the teams with really, really great chances. These are teams with some chance. These are teams with no chance. And I followed the rules. And so, obviously, my bracket's a disaster. And so, I'm going to go back to my previous method, which is guessing randomly. When I was in elementary school, I am much more in the nerd category. And when I was in elementary school, I got to play my first video game, and that was Oregon Trail. Those from my generation. There's a little bit of a rite of passage. You buy your supplies. The point of the game was like your pioneers going from misery to Oregon, and you're willing to die for it apparently. And so you buy your supplies and you have your professions and everything. And like most boys, I would just buy ammo because we're not actually trying to get to Oregon. We're just trying to hunt animals in the little pixelated screen. And so I think I beat the game once. In all of my library hours in elementary school. That's what I did. I beat the game once. And then recently we were Christmas shopping and I found someone had taken that game and transitioned it to a card game to play with your kids. And I was like, this is fantastic. Like, this is all of my nostalgia coming out. And so I bought it for the kids and we got the game and we're playing on Christmas morning. And I'm like, we're finally going to do it. I am a grown man. I have a college degree. Like, I'm somewhat educated. We're going to get to Oregon this time, fam. And so the way the game works, though, the card game is you play a card, you make your little distance, and then you, almost every card, it tells me to draw a catastrophe card. I'm like, well, that's fine. And I draw the catastrophe card. First pull of the game, you are bitten by a snake and die. And I'm like, what? There's no redos. There's no, like, unless you have, no, it was just you get bit by a snake and die. And I'm like, well, guys, good luck. This is what's insane to me is that my kids, they love this game. That's impossible to beat. There's a card that will kill everyone if you don't have warm clothes, which makes sense. Like, if you get hit by a snowstorm, don't have warm clothes, you die. Like, everyone dies. If your oxen die, everyone dies. You can get cholera and just die. Like, there are so many ways to lose this game. I'm like, I would never go to Oregon again. Like, why would you go? And if you're from Oregon, I'm sorry, Drew. Like, I'm sorry. But this is what's interesting is I found never wanting to play this game. I don't want to play this game. I don't like this game because I feel like the game designers have designed a game that's intended for you to not win, which is very frustrating. My kids, though, they've done something very biblical with this game. They've house ruled at our table where everyone gets one resurrection, and I'm like, this is very Eastery or creepy, I guess. That's what we do, and now we win. If everyone can live, even when they die, we still win. But to that point, it's very frustrating to me to play a game where I feel like the designers designed the game for me to not win. And as we are walking with Ruth in her journey, we're now in chapter 3. And I feel like the author is addressing that question as he is looking at the hardship of life during the season of the judges, a time where evil was prolific, where everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes. And everyone is just doing horrible, horrible atrocities, like the kind of things you don't talk about in church. They're doing all of those things. And you're like, and then it's just people are suffering. And it's just brutal, and it's nationwide, and it's centuries of pain and sorrow and evil. And this is the question. Like, God, have you designed this story? Have you written this story with us losing in mind? Like, do you care? And this has been the hearty echo of the first two chapters of Ruth, where God is reminding as we walk through and get to step into the lives of Naomi and Ruth. Naomi, who is now a widow, and her two sons have died. And Ruth was married to one of those sons and is also just a young widow. We have seen God providentially, out of his loving kindness for them, work through Boaz, work through Ruth, work through to demonstrate his providence and his steadfast love for these incredibly vulnerable women. And we have this assurance from the Lord, I am present, I am in control, and I will care for you. And it just gets echoed as we look at this, at these first two chapters, as Ruth meets Boaz, and she just so happens to happen upon his field, and it just so happens to be the barley harvest, and it just so happens that Boaz is like the one decent dude we've met during the time period of the judges, and he actually like cares for her and provides for her and protects for her, and you're like, the Lord is present, and he is loving, and he is working in these two women's lives, all right? So if you have your Bibles, I would ask that you would turn to Ruth chapter 3. This is where we are. And we're going to pick up the story. We ended last week with the wheat harvest happening, and Jason was talking about how in the culture of the Old Testament, God had designed the culture where if you were impoverished or if you were low income, this was your income. This is how you survived, was God designed it where you could glean from the corners of the field and anything that dropped. And so this is what Ruth has been doing. And the wheat harvest transitioned into the barley harvest. And so what we know is it's probably been about, as we step into chapter 3, it's been about 2 or 3 weeks where Ruth has been gleaning from these fields. And Naomi, her mother-in-law, says to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" I can pause here. Do you remember Ruth when she first came to Bethlehem? What was her heart? God has abandoned me. I am all alone. I'm left out full, and I have come back empty. This right here, like, it's just a simple question, and it's just a simple statement, and it's really easy to bypass, but we can't miss the fact that Naomi's focus is already, in these 3 weeks, something has happened in her heart where she is no longer living only in her grief and sorrow. Now, in chapter 1, she's never condemned for processing her pain. Like, the author's just like, this is where she is. But when you open up to the pages of chapter 3, you see that she is now looking at Ruth, and who's a young lady with no future. In that culture, in that time of day, if you were a young widow, you were profoundly vulnerable. Two reasons. One, this is the time period of the judges, right? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And you only need to, if you're like, how bad really was the last time period of the judges? Not right now, but if you want to be really depressed and just feel icky, go and read the last few chapters of Judges. And you're going to be like, this is horrible. Why did the pastor tell me to do this? I'm not. Like, if you want to, go for it. But it's really bad. And so, like, these women are super vulnerable with no man in that culture, in that patriarchal society. It was dangerous. Like, Naomi and Boaz both look at Ruth and they're like, leaving the house to go to a field is taking your life in your own hands. Like, that's how bad this age was. And so it's super dangerous in the immediate present, and they're living in poverty in the immediate present. But also, if you were a widow, especially a young widow, there was no social security system back then. Like, there was no Medicare. There was no 401k you could draw. There was no such thing as life insurance. So as you aged, and many cultures still operate on this, as you age, the cultural expectation is that your survival was dependent on your children. taking you in. And some of you parents are like, I'm really glad I'm not in that age anymore. but this is their future, is you have these two widows that have no children. And there is terror, not just for the immediate present, but also as they are looking down the road, there is only the rest of their lives to live in fear and poverty. And so Naomi turns and she says to Ruth, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? And this is what's beautiful, is that you see in the last, even just in those 2 or 3 weeks of her living during the harvest time, the only thing that has changed, because what hasn't changed is her circumstances in a lot of ways, right? Like she's still a widow. She's still lost her sons. But what she has experienced is the kind providence and the beautiful provision of the Lord. And this is the question, what changes? And we see in Naomi, and we see in chapter 3, we begin to unpack this question. What changes? If God really is providentially in control, and if God really does love us, how does that actually shape the practicalities of our life? How does that shape how we play the game if the designer did not just intend for us to lose? What does it free us to do? And this is the first hint. Naomi turns, and she looks at Ruth, and she says, let's try to figure out you. And she hatches this plan, which is a very strange plan. Verse 2, is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Okay, I want to pause here. This is not how we do dating, by the way. If you're like, this is very strange. Like, we don't begin our dating process like, who can I set you up with? Well, who are you related to? You're like, we don't do that. All right, they did do that. And you're like, that would not be strange or weird for them. And this is why. In God's system, remember how I was talking about, like, if you were a widow, you're super vulnerable. God's system in ancient Israel was that the closest male relative of the widow was responsible. He was intended to take responsibility for the care and provision and also giving this widow children by which, when he dies, she will still be taken care of. And you're like, that's really not normal. And you're like, well, it was also 2,500 years ago. So, yep, it's very strange. But that was God's system of provision. And so that is why Naomi's like, Boaz is a guy that is intended to take responsibility for our care. Like, he's on the list. He's a relative. Wash, therefore. Oh, sorry. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. And you're like, what is winnowing barley? You don't have winnowing barley parties? That's weird. No. Winnowing barley was, this is what you need to know. It's the final step in the harvest process. In the process of growing the barley and cutting the barley and then making the barley where you can make barley tea or barley grain, whatever, barley cakes. This was the final step in the process. It was a time of big celebration. It was also a time where it's like getting your quarterly paycheck all at once. Like, that's the deal. And so the threshing floor was a time of great celebration, but also in the time period of the judges, it was a time when men would spend their money on really, really not good things. Does that make sense? And so this is what's going on. It did not have a good reputation, but this is Naomi's plan. See, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash yourself, therefore, because you've been outside in the fields all day. Anoint yourself, make your hair nice. Put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. And then go uncover his feet. And lie down, and he will tell you what to do. Okay, now I'm going to pause here. All right, remember how you read this and you're like, so culturally this is going to make sense. Nope, culturally this makes zero sense. You're like, this is not a good plan. Like, this would not be a good plan in 2021. This is also a very weird, strange plan in ancient Israel. It was, remember how I was like, it's dangerous for a widow to leave her house and go to a field. Also dangerous to go in the middle of the night to the threshing floor. There's all of the not good connotations that go alongside that. This plan is incredibly risky because this is the risk tethered to it, not just to Ruth, but also if Boaz wakes up and misinterprets her intentions. You tracking? If he misinterprets her intentions, there is zero chance he's going to marry this girl. And there's zero, like, her reputation goes through the floor. This is what we're doing. And you may be thinking, like, why doesn't Naomi, this is what I thought, this is what came to my mind as I was studying this text. Why didn't Naomi just get coffee with Boaz? Like, I feel like this is really, you Google or you find his email and you're just like, Boaz, can we have coffee? Like, and just talk about Ruth, my wonderful daughter-in-law. And you're, that's not how it works. For two reasons. One, they didn't, I don't think they had coffee yet or Starbucks. And secondly, more importantly, it was considered highly inappropriate for a woman to initiate a relationship with a man on any level. And you might say, that's very archaic. And I would say, yes, it is very archaic. This is a very archaic story. So it's the world they lived in. And so Naomi did not, like, this is how low in the social stratosphere Ruth and Naomi were. Naomi could not even approach Boaz without it being a scandal. That's how low they were. And they knew it. You have to go in the middle of the night, and it's tonight. So we're gonna go ahead and hatch this plan. Is there risk? Yes, but we're gonna do this. Verse 5. And Ruth replied, "All that you say, I will do." You're like, okay, here we go. And this is where the story gets more strange. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. Verse 7. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, because it's your quarterly paycheck and it's the time period of the judges and all of your money, grain, is just laying there. And so why is he sleeping out there? Because all of his grain is there. It's the middle of the night. He's got to sleep with it until he can transport it the next day. Verse 7. Then she came and softly uncovered his feet and lay down. Okay, this is a pretty innocuous sentence in English. In Hebrew, this phrase, the language and the metaphors and the euphemisms that are embedded in this phrase are layered, and there's three different ways that the author sets up the sentence where you're like, this is a, I can't translate the euphemisms because we're in church. Does that make, just nod your heads? Like, this is scandalous. The author has intentionally piled on the euphemisms for the reader as they're reading through it. You're watching this wonderful lady Ruth meet with this godly man Boaz, and he sets up all of this innuendo, and you're like, whoa, it's sad. No, you're intended. This is the part in the romantic comedy where you're like, this is going to be a train wreck. Like, you're supposed to feel this tension of this godly woman. You're like, Ruth, I love you. You're doing all of the right things, and this is all of the wrong things. This is really, really bad. You're supposed to feel the tension, all right? What is she doing? This can go, this is the author's intention. We're supposed to feel the fear of, this can go sideways very quickly. We have every expectation, it being the time period of the judges, Ruth being where she is, who she is, and how we've seen human beings interact with each other all through the judges. This is going to be a train wreck. He said to her, verse 8. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over. And behold, there's a woman at his feet. And he said, who are you? This is great. And she said, I am Ruth, your servant. Okay. Now remember, what was Naomi's instructions? Lay at his feet. See what he does. That's your plan. Ruth does not do that. All right, I love Ruth all the more for this. She says, I am Ruth, your servant, your handmaiden, so to speak. And then she says this, spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. And this is the plot twist, and this is what no one sees coming, is Ruth to say that particular sentence. And this is the beauty of this sentence, is what she does is, that phrase, if you've been with us the last few weeks, that phrase, spread your wings over your servant, you're like, I feel that phrase before. That's because that is one of the first things Boaz said to her. If you flip back to chapter 2, verse 12, his blessing, his prayer over her, the Lord repay you for what you have done, a full reward be given by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And that's like the first thing he says to her. And her response to him in the middle of the night, in the middle of the threshing floor, is Boaz. I am your handmaiden. Spread your wings over me. And this, you're like, oh, that's so sweet. There, it is, but it's also a euphemism for marriage. So this is the greatest thing about this story. So you have, remember how I said like Ruth and Naomi were at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom of the social tier? All right, this is what's going on. Ruth has approached this dude in the middle of the night, and at the bottom of the social tier, she's looking at a landowner, male, in a patriarchal society who has all of the power, and she says, hey, I'm Ruth. This is what you need to do. You need to marry me. This is not a question. I love it. It's not even a proposal. Like, this is an imperative. This young lady's looking at this rich dude, and she's like, you need to marry me. And you're like, that's fantastic. I love it. And everyone would be shocked, because we're in progressive 2021, and it's still like, guys, if you're going to do anything, like, please propose. Like, have at least that initiative. And Ruth just takes it on herself. This is what you need to do, Boaz. And we're all like holding our breath. Like, what's this guy going to do? This is incredibly inappropriate. All of this is incredibly inappropriate. This is an audacious risk. Verse 10. Oh, she says, spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer, referencing the kinsman redeemer piece. The relative that was intended to take responsibility for them. Verse 10, and he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. All right. What does he mean, kindness? Like, is he just the super insecure guy? Of like, I'm older. And he was older. The way he speaks the terminology of daughter says that there is an age gap. We know he's not really old because he's out laboring in the field. But we also know, given the language, that there's some years between the two. I don't think so. I don't think this is like, oh, you're so kind by thinking you want to marry me. Like, I don't think that's it. This is it. It has to do with the Redeemer piece. Because he says, you could have married anyone. Young men, whether poor or rich. But you chose me because I am my Redeemer. Wait, why does that matter for Boaz? It doesn't matter for Boaz. Ruth could have found her own security and peace and provision by marrying any of the guys. This is what Boaz is recognizing. You could have married anyone. You're young. You're pretty. There's lots of guys. You could have sought after any of them. But you chose me because I'm a Redeemer. Not for Ruth's good. But for who? For Naomi. She intentionally is choosing Boaz because she is seeking out Naomi's good. Because only the Redeemer would be responsible to take on the rest of Naomi's life, the care and provision and protection of Naomi. If Ruth were to go out and marry another guy, he could look at Naomi and be like, yep, nope, you're on your own. Leaving Naomi the rest of her life to be a widow and to live in poverty. And Ruth looks at that and she says, I am going to submit to Naomi and I'm going to pursue Boaz to ensure Naomi's care. And this is the crazy thing. You have these, we watch these two ladies with so who have hurt so much, they're in so much pain, and they don't have anything. And there's so much at risk. How in the world? And yet we see Naomi moving for the good of Ruth, and we see Ruth moving for the good of Naomi. And you're like, how can you do that? Because there's so much at risk. And if you don't fight and cling and grapple for your own good, you might be the rest of your life impoverished. Like, can't you just first take care of your own needs? Can't you just do what is best for you? Isn't that the language you use all the time? This is what you need to do. You need to do what's good for you. And they're not. They're looking at one another, and you're like, how could they do that? They do that, they're able to do that because they have been freed. Because the last few weeks, what they have experienced time and time again is the providential loving kindness of God. God is taking care of Naomi. Naomi, therefore, is able to take care of Ruth. God is taking care of Ruth. Therefore, Ruth is freed to be able to take an audacious risk for the good of Naomi. I think sometimes we think obedience in the midst of difficulties has more to do with just pep talk and guilt-tripping myself and shaming myself into doing the right thing. And if I don't do the right thing, it's because I didn't shame or guilt and I didn't white-knuckle it enough. And I don't think that's necessarily biblical. I think what we see here in this story is obedience flows out of a steadfast confidence in the Lord, that the Lord is present, the Lord is in sovereign control over the details and even my pain, and he is going to take care of me. And so I can step out in obedience feeling great risk because there's no risk. Because it's a felt risk, yes. Actual risk, no. He's there. And now, my daughter, verse 11. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do all that you have asked. For my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true, I am a redeemer. And if we're maybe in the back of your mind when I'm like, Boaz is a redeemer, and are you supposed to take responsibility? Maybe you're like, well, why didn't he do it from the very beginning? This is why. He says, but there's a redeemer nearer than I. That's why. There's another guy. And you're like, oh, no, what's going to happen? There's another dude? This is a love triangle? I hate love triangles. Don't worry, it's going to be okay. Chapter 4, come back next week. It is true, there's a redeemer nearer than I. Verse 13, remain tonight. Because there's still a question. You're still on the threshing floor. She's still a vulnerable woman, and Boaz is still a dude. And this is what he says. Remain tonight. And in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I love Boaz, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until morning. Gosh, that's so beautiful. And all of the euphemisms are gone at this point. It's very straightforward. Go to sleep. Rest. What did Naomi start off the chapter looking for? Rest for Ruth. What does Boaz want for Ruth? Rest. It's incredible. Boaz steps in and he says, I will take care of you. I will be responsible. If it means kicking the dude in the pants and be like, do what you need to do. This is what the law of God says. Do the, like, take responsibility for these women. Is it going to cost you? Yes. Is it more mouths to feed? Yes. Also, this is what God has commanded of you. And he says, but if he doesn't do that, I'll take care of you. So she lay at his feet until morning, but arose before one could recognize one another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came out to the threshing floor. Why not? For all of the obvious, for all the connotations, it's not good connotations. He's protecting her purity. He's protecting her reputation. And also the future marriage that they're about to have. He doesn't want any questions to be asked. He wants to protect their purity and the purity of the marriage to come. And so he says, let it be known. And then he says, verse 15, bring out the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she holds out her little thing, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her, and then she went into the city. And you're like, what in the world? Like, why bother with the details about barley? Hold on, this is why. She came to her mother-in-law, and she said, how did you fare, my daughter? And then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And this also... Hebrew writers, they love to do parentheses. And this is another parenthesis. Flip back to chapter 1, verse 21. This is Naomi processing her grief and her sorrow. She says, I went away full. And the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi bitter when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity on me? And in chapter 3, you see this wonderful closure as Boaz looks at Ruth and he says, Naomi will be empty no more. You see Boaz selflessly providing and providing fullness as a means of the Lord to demonstrate providential loving kindness for Naomi. Like it all comes back full circle. So she reports, these six measures of barley he gave to me. For he said, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Verse 18, I love Naomi. She's like, I understand. Wait, my daughter, until you learn how this matter turns out. For this man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. And you're like, yup. This is what I love. She's like, I understand how guys work a little bit. Boaz is going to go do the thing. He's going to take care of it. Let's see how it turns out. And you're like, all right. So how does this... What does this say about life? As we finish this chapter, we get to marvel together how the Lord's divine providence and divine love has shaped how these three people interact towards one another. Each person in their own way is markedly other focused, even in the midst of difficult, painful circumstances. Like the way forward is super complex, yeah. But we see the beautiful example of individuals whose souls are being formed by the loving providence of God. Like this is how God shapes us. God is present and providing, so Naomi did not need to be first and foremost concerned with grappling with her own good. God was providentially present and loving, and so Ruth did not need to be primarily concerned with her own good. Only out of a freeing knowledge that God's divine love and God's divine providence were these individuals able to sacrificially move towards one another. This is the sweet, sweet truth. My family, we've been fostering for years, along with others here. And one of the questions that gets asked is isn't it really hard? And they said, well, yeah, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I've done some hard things. This is the hardest thing I've ever done. Why do you do it? Because this is God's call. And so out of God's care, and this is what I've seen time and time again, out of God's care, He has provided and taken care of my kids in the midst of pain and trauma, and he's taking care of us. But this is the other thing I've seen as we love on kids from hard places. One of the things that is very common from kids from hard places who have been neglected or abused is that when small things happen, when they presume you might take a stuffed animal, or when they think they might not get dessert, or when they think you might not care for them, they lose their mind. They go from 0 to 250 miles an hour in half a second. Why? Because they have been trained to think, because of their trauma and their past and their wounds, that if they don't fight for themselves, no one will. That if they don't lose their mind and do everything in their little power and in their little body to control and to take care of themselves, you will not. And y'all, like we do this. Like we have our own wounds. Like we have our trauma in our story. We have our areas and the things in our life that have conditioned us to be like, you can't trust, you have to fight here. This battle, if you don't fight and win this battle with your wife, you will lose and it will hurt too much. If you don't fight and win this battle with your child, you will lose and it will be too much. Because no one will take care of you. If you don't fight and win this battle with your finances, if you don't bend the rules, if you don't shift and manipulate things to get what you need and protect your own, it will cost you and it will be the end. And the enemy sells us the lie. I'm going to invite the band back up. calls us. He calls us lovingly and kindly and with great patience, but he calls us to participate sacrificially in the work of, in his work in the lives of others. Yeah, he calls us to step into the messes, to step into the complexities, oftentimes at cost of our own comfort, the cost of our own plans, to give of ourselves, to demonstrate, that we might demonstrate his love in the midst of a broken, jacked up world. And he tells us, like, and in doing so, you put on display in your places, in your circles of influence, before your kids, before your spouse, like, we put on display his love. And the thing that the Spirit is bringing to your mind, where you're like, I don't know if I can let this go. I don't know if I can lose this. I have to fight for this. Can I? You have a kinsman redeemer. Jesus stepped in and purchased his bride. Out of a love that demanded nothing from you and promised your good. There is not a question mark, there is surety. And we can rest there. I want to pray. Lord, I lift up my brothers and sisters. Loving others is difficult. Loving others with wounds and baggage of their own is difficult. And living in the middle of a jacked up world is difficult. And yet, Lord, you have given us the freedom with confidence move towards the pain, to sacrificially give, because this is precisely what you've done. You've promised and you have accomplished the securing of our future, the securing of our good. You have demonstrated the steadfastness of your love for us. Help us to live that out. Lord, I also pray for those in this room that they hear this story and they hear of the promises and the demonstration of how you move towards us, and it's maybe out of shame or fear, haven't experienced it. Lord, I just ask that your Holy Spirit would draw them to yourself. Break the hearts. May they see and experience your steadfast love. And in Jesus' name, we can pray with absolute confidence. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. For more information about Summit Upstate and other available resources, check out our website at summitupstate.org.